China actually expanded the number of university places. It didn't reduce. Like, there were fewer young people of university age, but suddenly many more university places. So the intent was the smaller population of the future working age would have a higher productivity potential because they'd be much more educated than the large demographic bubble of the 1950s and 60s.
You are listening to In Pursuit of Development with Dan Banik.
An article in The Economist magazine in September 2018 argued that high birth rates is one of the main culprits for pervasive poverty on the African continent. This article in particular cited the example of Tanzania, where the then President John Magufuli did not apparently see the point with birth control, having announced in 2016 that women could throw away their contraceptives as state schools will be free. President Magufuli subsequently claimed that a major consequence of widespread contraception is a shrinking labor force, which in turn is bad for development. But others, including the Gates Foundation, have pointed to countries such as the Democratic Republic of Congo and Nigeria, which are projected to witness massive increases in their populations in the next few decades. And such rapid population growth, they argue, can potentially pose major challenges for government policies aimed at promoting the well-being of citizens. So what is the link between population and development? And are there some lessons that the world can learn from China's attempts at controlling population growth in recent decades? To discuss these issues, I'm joined by Lauren Johnston, who's a research associate at SOAS China Institute, and currently a World Bank consultant for a population aging and China research project. Lauren holds a PhD in economics from Peking University and is widely published on topics relating to China's economy with respect to demographics and economic ties with Africa. Lauren and I discuss the links between population, economic growth and development, East Asian experiences of getting rich before getting old, China's one-child policy and its impact, and whether there are some lessons from China for African countries with younger populations. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Welcome to the show, Lauren. It's really lovely to see you here.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I've been looking forward and I love your podcast. So thank you.
Lauren, I'd like to begin by discussing with you the overarching links between population and development. And I'm particularly interested in starting on this note because, you know, for many years I've been interested in understanding what works in development. And among the numerous developmental successes that the world has experienced is, of course, rising life expectancy. So, you know, on average, I think we live more than what is the figure is, I think, over 70 now, right? So most people are living longer, you know, we have access to better healthcare, medicines, etc. But this is also leading to a lot of people fear a rise in the number of people that this world can carry. And there is this increased sort of polarized debate on population growth. And you have all of these climate change advocates saying that population is the elephant in the room and we will have already exceeded the so-called carrying capacity of the world. Others say, no, these are ethical issues, that really it is a problem of the rich world. It's not the poor countries that should be, you know, asked to control their population. So let me start with a very broad question. How do you see this current debate, Lauren? And what would you highlight as the key aspects that we should be looking at in this population-development relationship?
I guess the key aspect is productivity. So if you go back to the days of Malthus, even at that point, I'm not actually even sure when it was, maybe 100 years ago, there was concern that the population was too large. And at that point, that was partly because the productivity of agriculture at that point wasn't nearly as high as today. So there was concerns for food supply, even in Europe, let alone elsewhere. And what undermined an aspect of Malthus' theory was that food productivity per acre of arable land became much, much higher than he had expected. So I think that the human carrying capacity purpose, I mean, obviously there's these distributional issues around who's actually consuming all the resources. If you put the distributional aspect aside, then really also productivity is an issue. And yeah, I guess if you take it, you know, long run, you have these poor young country, I guess the poorest, youngest country, I think, is Niger, and the richest, oldest one is Japan. And every country lies in that spectrum and is either very deliberately or not deliberately at all kind of managing the relationship between economic and demographic change. And in developing countries, they're usually pre-demographic dividend. So they've got this potential for a future ripe period of high working age population share. Whereas today, obviously, most rich countries are past that peak and now they have falling working age population share. So there's every country is kind of in that spectrum somewhere and has to work out both their domestic economic demography balance over time and in the current time. And then, you know, the poor countries need, and then in international context, like you also have to factor in the economic demography circumstance of your trade partners and your investment partners. So I guess that's the kind of macro lens. And I think overpopulation, that question comes back to productivity and distribution of resources. I don't have any particular ethical perspectives on it.
Some people feel that we should be talking more about family planning and controlling population. Others say, you know, that is really not the way forward. I was just reminded of the late President Magufuli in Tanzania, who said very famously, I think it was a few years ago, that population control or family planning is a sign of parental laziness. And so, you know, his argument, as many other leaders, not just in Africa, but also elsewhere, is that this is a good thing for Africa to have a young population. So you shouldn't be talking about controlling population growth. This is good. Whereas in the rich world, I think there is often this feeling that, you know, we should be talking more about it than we are currently.
Yeah, I definitely think, I mean, they're two extremes. Like in Tanzania, you have a very young population. And say in Norway, where you are, you have a much older, richer population. In the case of Magufuli's views, my perspective on that take is fair enough if your country has the preference that every household, I think the TFR in Tanzania is something like four or five, three to four range at least, if not five. So it's not Africa's highest, but it's well above replacement. So I guess that the purpose then is, well, if you can deliver per capita income gains such that, I mean, if you seek for your population to benefit from that youth, then you need to kind of structure everything around that. Now, how you do that, I'm not sure. But, you know, if you have the demographic profile of the traditional pyramid, somehow you need to, in order that those children don't suffer, or, you know, they can ideally see a doctor if they're sick or whatever, you need to somehow come up with a formula that can work to cater to such a high youth share. And I don't think any country has done that perfectly yet, has had a traditional population pyramid and delivered like a really wonderful standard of living to all of its children. So hopefully, if a country can, great. But I haven't seen a case of it yet, except perhaps in the extreme case of lots of oil that is fairly distributed. Maybe that could be a case of high resources, but there's no perfect case so far.
So, Lauren, in your work, a term that frequently crops up is, of course, the demographic dividend. And you've often written about the various phases that a demographic transition goes through in terms of an economic context. You've written about the pre-transition phase, the early transition phase, the late transition phase, and the post-transition phase. So could you help us better understand this concept of the demographic dividend and these different phases that we can place the countries in the world in?
They're not my definition, or they're not my categorizations. The World Bank kindly offers in its World Development Indicators database every country's indicators in terms of total fertility rate or share of population age 65 and over around those, or it offers the kind of cutoff threshold. So you have pre-transition, which is basically a very high youth share, a country with a total fertility rate or a share of over 65 that's a share of over 65 that's very low and a share of youth that's very high would be typically a pre-transition country. So this is which has a very high youth share. And then you have the kind of always early transition phase, which is when demographic transition has begun, which is basically when morbidity rates start to fall. And so ultimately then does the total fertility rate. And at the same time, morbidity rates falling means older people are living longer. So you get this older population share. And so that's the demographic transition as a kind of like it's basically a transition of the population structure from being, you know, a pyramid almost to becoming more of a cylinder. And, you know, now in the case of Korea and Japan, it's almost becoming an upside down pyramid. Not yet. It hasn't got that far. But and then the demographic dividend, which there's a lot of talk of this prospect and this hope for Africa and future, is when you basically have a very high working age population share. So the idea is that you can have much faster productivity gains because a high share of your population is in their productive prime. They're not young and needing caring. They're not old and needing caring and taking pensions and seeing the doctor regularly. They're in their working age healthy prime. So if you have a large population share in that phase, theoretically you can extract, you know, from that and utilize that for a much faster rate of, or, you know, process of development. But actually most countries in Africa are not in that phase. They're pre that phase. They're younger than that. And it won't be, obviously each one is different. Maybe Morocco is in that phase now, perhaps. Mauritius is already past it, basically. Mauritius is already old. But most countries in Africa are very ahead of or before the demographic dividend. They won't get their demographic dividend till sometime this century. And that, of course, depends on morbidity and the total fertility rate. But that doesn't, I'm not, you know, if there's a miracle way to have a development formula where a young population share can be the source of some sort of welfare gains itself, then I'm not promoting demographic transition per se. It's just one should be aware of its impact and relationship on development. So, you know, East Asia obviously did extremely well in capturing its demographic dividend period. And now other countries would like to emulate that, you know, but you actually have to have the demographic transition in order to emulate what East Asia did, or you have to come up with a new formula.
So how do you place Japan at the moment? Because I know this is something that my students are always, you know, interested in further exploring, that you have a very old population, and then you also have a country with very restrictive immigration policies. And so, you know, what are your thoughts on Japan and maybe even South Korea?
Yeah, actually, South Korea has an even faster rate of aging. In fact, if we can just take the three kind of Northeast Asian giants, China, Korea, and Japan, in terms of this, the timing. So Japan is the world's oldest country, though Italy's competing. And it, I think its population of working age share has been falling since maybe 1994 or something around there, 1992. And so it's, you know, had a like almost three decades of falling working age population share. And in China began that phase in maybe 2010. So China's only had a decade of falling working age population share, and Korea is somewhere in the middle. But where they're also interesting is that in Japan, that turning point arrived when Japan was already rich, very, very rich, one of the per capita richest, most industrialized countries in the world in the 1990s. So you had a large cohort beginning to enter retirement who had enjoyed a very high income lifestyle during most of their lifespan. So you have these kind of high income population aging. Whereas the other case, China, the same large cohort born in the 1950s and 1960s, they're now also entering retirement. But that cohort had a very low income lifespan on average. So you really have kind of population aging. China is now upper middle income, but during most of those people's lives, China was low income, lower middle income. So, you know, they're really, their lifespan was a very low and lower middle income one. It wasn't a high income rich one. So these two very different kind of retiree cohorts almost. And in Korea, you have the in between of that. It's really, you know, it got old just as it got rich. So it had a population share over 65 of 7% or more right about when it entered the high income group. Whereas Japan became old long before, or sorry, it got rich long before it started getting old. And China's getting rich after it got old. So you have these amazing three case studies to kind of understand if, or to try to understand if we can see how the timing of population aging in the economic cycle itself affects how population aging affects the economy. You know, you wouldn't expect a kind of, I don't loosely use the word peasant, but, you know, a peasant Chinese retiree who's not actually even consumed much. They've not been a big consumer all their life. And now they're, you know, the same type of consumer, a marginal consumer in their retirement. So maybe their work is no longer available, but they're probably now a grandparent and doing some housework. Or maybe they've even been replaced by a machine. Whereas in Japan, you have these super consumers who were like very rich, very prosperous, buying. They've moved into retirement. So their loss and their human capital, like they've got university degrees and so on. The loss of a current type of labor unit in Japan is in some ways higher than in China because of the educational gap. And because of the role in the economy, these high income, older Japanese played, you know. So I just think comparing the share of old in a population is a very, very narrow way of understanding the population aging problem of a country. It's so much more tied up with the lifespan and the impact and the marginal propensity to consume or whatever it is of the cohort that's retiring and of the old.
But what do you think about immigration policies, which are hotly debated in Europe and many of our, you know, countries, both in Norway but also in the region? You know, the way in which one addresses aging and the need for more productive, a younger workforce is, of course, to allow for immigration, to get, you know, young people, qualified people to work in our countries. But that isn't always the case in East Asia, is it? I mean, especially Japan. So do you think that kind of restrictive immigration policies would impact countries that do pursue restrictive immigration policies? So I'm just trying to get at this link between immigration and aging?
I think it depends how Japan responds to its change population structure. Like if the society is, if the economy is unable to replace labor with capital, which obviously is, there's no perfect substitute now, and there are certain roles that are unfulfilled, and an immigrant can serve those roles, then, you know, it may be logical to have more immigration. At the same time, to the extent that countries are going to lack highly qualified labor, so I'm not talking about more less educated services, jobs or otherwise, but, you know, like to the extent they're losing retiring engineers and retiring scientists and so on, and they need to import tech capacity or whatever from elsewhere. As populations age, the competition even for that type of immigration will increase. So it's that the immigration story kind of assumes there's an infinite supply of labor elsewhere. And in terms of high quality talent, that's probably not the case. There's a bit of competition for where they will go. That also involves a loss of human capital for the developing country if that's the high-skilled ones mostly leaving. And it's not necessarily a perfect substitute at the other end in terms of language skills, so on. There's obviously a lot of preconditions of investment to even turn that into a high, into like an equal functioning unit of labor, if that makes sense. So, you know, learning Japanese and so on. So I think on the one hand, it makes sense. On the other hand, I think it's a bit sticky in practice because it's not quite a perfect substitute. And then it means in many cases, a loss of human resources for the developing countries. And I think even India, for example, now is a falling, you know, total fertility rate and so on. So it's not a permanent solution either. Like it's not like in maybe 100 years there'll be like a lower TFR everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's a period, and then the world overall has a lower population. Who knows? Like maybe some countries will go through a period of population decline even. So I think that's another. There's one side, there's a sticky, challenging immigration story, which is kind of sticky for both developing countries and rich ones. And then there's a population decline argument and navigating population decline, which is a whole nother minefield.
Let's move on to China, Lauren. And a lot of your work, of course, focuses on China. And China is often seen to be one of the most successful countries in trying to reduce population growth. And the official Chinese narrative, of course, claims that the one-child policy, this famous one-child policy that was in place between, was it 1980 and 2016, apparently that averted over 400 million births, which in turn, according to the Chinese authorities, help propel the country towards this kind of impressive economic development, poverty reduction within just a few decades. And there's also this argument coming from the Chinese that it has helped the global environmental agenda. So this is all win-win. But is that really the case? And could you help us better understand the origins of this one-child policy and the kind of impact that has had in China in the last 4 or 5 decades?
Actually, just to answer your first point about has it helped the environment. On the one hand, it has because there are 400 million fewer consumers and so on. But on the other hand, if those 400 million people existed, China probably wouldn't be the giant that it is today, and it wouldn't have the footprint it has today. So, you know, the net effects on the environment are very difficult to determine. On the one-child policy, yeah, so China had, you know, periods of fostering population growth under Mao. And then in, you know, shortly after Deng Xiaoping launched this new era of opening and reform in late 1978, so in 1980, there was some understanding in an order, how can we realize this goal as fast as we can? And how can we modernize our economy as quickly as we can? And, you know, the highest number of births in China, I think, was in the 1950s, but especially the 1960s. And there was some concern, as far as I understand it, that if that cohort of 1950s, 60s generation all had three children, you know, two, three, four children, that this would kind of balloon out China's population again, and that it would be impossible for China to realize the per capita productivity gains that it had intended to realize under this opening and reform and for modernization goals. So in the 1970s, they started to reduce the TFR via this program of longer, later, fewer. So wait longer till you have children or have them older. And then, sorry, have that, have them later. Wait longer between them. So, you know, have spaced them out a bit more and have fewer overall. So already in the 1970s, there was a falling birth rate. And then for whatever reason, this one-child policy was introduced to kind of almost to cement that. And I guess it's the only case of state-led demographic transition, which does make it a kind of interesting economic demography story, because no other country, as far as I can see, instigated, like imposed demographic transition. And if it was to reduce the number of mouths to feed, or if it was to accelerate per capita development, I'm not 100% sure. But what I understand is that it led to an amazing thinking of the relationship between population and development in ways that other countries weren't, because the demographic transition was a state-led one. And so then the state thought about, how do we make demographic transition work for us? Like, you know, we have to make this working age population share boom that will come, you know, from the kind of late 80s till the around 2010. So the 1990s, 2000s, we have to make that work for our development. We have to go gangbusters to make that labor-intensive, low-wage demographic dividend work. But at the same time, we have to prepare for when they all get old, because there are going to be so many old people, hundreds of millions of old people. And we have to make sure when they get old, they don't destroy the next phase of development. And I just don't think any other country was thinking that far ahead in terms of that relationship. And that really, as far as I can understand it, it came from the one-child policy, but maybe also a very lucky coincidence. The day after Deng Xiaoping made his speech in 1978, the UN passed Resolution 3352, and that was on population aging, and that the world kind of needed to address these rising challenges of population aging. And China then attended the resulting conference in Vienna in 1982. And so just as they entered their demographic dividend, youthful, rich period, they kind of jumped on this rich country dialogue about population aging. You know, maybe that helped them to think about not only capturing the demographic dividend, but also being ready for aging.
But they were thinking about also the East Asian stories, right? Hong Kong, Japan, and Singapore, Taiwan, all of these countries that got rich before getting old. They were concerned about that, as well as perhaps, you know, what happened during the famine, the Great Leap Forward famine, and estimated, and I've seen all kinds of figures about this. Some claim even 35 million people died from that famine. So to what extent do you think these policies in the 80s, and of course you mentioned the 1970s policy about, what was it called again? Waiting or a long...
Longer, later, fewer.
Longer, later, fewer, yeah. So to what extent do you think it was this, not competition as much as the awareness of the East Asian experience and also the experience from the famine that shaped this one-child policy?
I'm not really an expert in all of the political details of the decision-making to introduce a one-child policy. And indeed, there's the kind of fear of not being able to, even today, there's a rising sense of food insecurity in China, let alone in early 1980s with that history of famine from the mid and later mid 20th century. So sure, there was pressure to increase agricultural productivity and to potentially diminish the number of mouths to feed. And then looking at these countries in the region that, you know, China really referenced Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore, Japan, and later to some extent South Korea, like their development paths. And that was like in the mid-1980s when they'd already imposed the one-child policy, and then they were thinking about what are all the consequences? What are the consequences that, what if this damages our prospects rather than helps it? And they came up with this, like it was Wu Changping came up with this phrase, getting old before rich. And whereas Taiwan, Singapore, those economies had got rich when they were still young, China started coming up with all the factors that getting old before rich might mean, that might inhibit China from becoming like Taiwan, Singapore, Japan, and Hong Kong. You know, first of all, they would have no reference point because those countries got rich when they were still young. China wouldn't, there was no feasible growth rate that would mean China could get rich while it was still young. Then China would face labor supply pressures, you know, when its population and economic system had not developed to a level that might enable it to compete with wages at that level, or compete, you know, with wages of such a level, because its aging would be a bit premature. I think they have that phrase, like premature aging. And then, of course, right when they're still trying to direct resources to development and even alleviate the extremes of poverty, they'll have to be now shifting all these resources to provide pensions and care and so on for the old. And all of these kind of that unfavorable dependency scenario would inhibit China ever being able to get rich. So that was that, like, but the difference is they've actually been thinking about it for all that time because of those fears, because they realized they would get old before rich. They seem to have taken that into account all through these last, you know, four decades. So, you know, in terms of really going turbocharging to maximize the demographic dividend period of low wage export-led growth. And then when the one-child policy generation reached university age in 1998, from 1998 on, China actually expanded the number of university places. It didn't reduce, like there were fewer young people of university age, but suddenly many more university places. So the intent was the smaller population of the future working age would have a higher productivity potential because they'd be much more educated than the large demographic bubble of the 1950s and 60s. So you have this deliberate intent that, okay, we'll have fewer workers as a share of population, but those workers will be much more productive in theory. They'll be able to be much more productive. And their productivity potential will enable China to keep growing through this population aging kind of period, which I add is only expected to last till the 1950s, when there'll be a peak old share and the share of old will start to fall. So they've really been thinking about how to craft a population and development strategy that caters to the different population weights over time in a development context, which I don't think any other country has ever done like they did. Whether they succeed or not, it's a different story. There's lots of challenges. But they have at least really tried to think about it and plan for it.
Yeah, I read in one of your articles, you refer to the literature showing that this longer, later, fewer policy perhaps was more successful than the one-child policy in reducing fertility rates. And this whole longer, later, fewer meaning, later marriage, and longer birth intervals and fewer lifetime births, that perhaps was less intrusive than this one-child policy, which many, according to, you know, many of my friends and colleagues, has been pretty traumatic. So I'm just thinking, Lauren, is it possible to say that that longer, later, fewer strategy was perhaps quite successful and it could have continued and one didn't perhaps need this one child policy?
I know of many scholars, Marty White and at Harvard and others, who say that, like that they can't believe there was that introduction because the total fertility rate in any case was falling, and consequences of the one child policy in terms of skewed gender birth ratios and a kind of acceleration of gaps between rural and urban areas. Girls were disproportionately aborted in rural areas and so on. So you have all sorts of gaps and inequalities, and also the micro level traumas. Like, this is that I'm talking at the macro level, not the actual acts of imposing the policy. The exact logic of what there's apparently, I think he's an aeronautical engineer, Sung Jen, maybe, who in the 70s came up with some kind of ideal population level for China. Whether or not the one child policy was part of that, or wherever it came from, you know, whether it was a growth plan and one generation would experience trauma so that children born in China in 1930s and sorry in the 2020s and 2030s would be the beneficiaries ultimately. I don't know. So if I don't know why they turned the longer, later, fewer campaign into a one-child policy. I try to study the policy thinking that came after it, and then obviously even how they're dealing with the resulting inequalities.
But the general consensus, Lauren, and correct me if I'm wrong, around the world now, is that any policy of population control that is based on coercion, including forced abortions, is really not the desired alternative for others to follow, right? Because I'm also thinking not just about China, but also India, where there were all of these instances of forced sterilization, other abuses that really characterized population control policies. Was it from the late 1970s? And these have been widely criticized.
Any coercive population policy is obviously a challenge for human rights.
Right. And even in a democracy like India, there was this trampling on the rights of its citizens. So in terms of the kind of policies you think, and I don't know if you worked on this, and the kind of policies that India implemented, how were they worse or better than the one-child policy in China? Were there any similarities and differences? Obviously, it wasn't as rigorously implemented in India. There wasn't an official policy, but it was more about encouraging sterilizations.
To be honest, I'm not like even an expert in the micro side of how China imposed the one child policy, let alone mm-hmm. how India has. I mean, there's a very strong relationship between per capita income gains and lifetime opportunity expectations and the number of children people have on average. So I guess there's this trade-off. You know, you need to give people the belief that they can realize those elevated income gains and elevated educational gains, and then they will choose to have fewer children anyway, based on historical precedent. So really, like, there's you know, push and pull ways in that sense, and at least giving people the preference of determining their household size. And if a country is concerned about its population growth rate, then somehow they need to create a structure that encourages people to go to university and therefore start later, or so on and so on. I'm really not an expert in this balance of productive choices and the national macro framework around that. So what India did versus what China has done and the trauma of that. You know, I'm from Australia. I'm from a country that has not, as in recent times, has not had any such questions or debates. So I don't personally know about that.
But China has changed its policy, and over the years that I've been going to China, I've noticed how things have changed. I remember telling you a few weeks ago about my experience of taking my two children and my wife and two sons. You know, we were in Beijing and I was teaching there several years ago. And these two kids of mine, they look a bit similar to each other. There was this fascination on the streets. We were often stopped and people wanted to take pictures. And a lot of my friends just were, you know, just so happy to see how you could have two children and they could turn out similar or different. But this longing for the second child that many middle-class families that I know in China often dreamed of. And of course, in recent years, that is possible now. Why do you think there was that change in policy? Is it because of concerns of the problem of missing women, that, you know, that there were just too few women going around, which is a problem in China, as in also in India? And I think Amartya Sen and others have written extensively about it. But what do you think happened to make the authorities tone down that one-child policy?
I guess that depends on your assumptions of why they implemented it in the first place. I don't have a clear picture of exactly why they did. But if one takes it as a per capita kind of development strategy or part of, and if one considers China may have been nervous about its ability to feed its people and therefore avoid another famine and so on, then by 2016, you have the people who would have been forming families in 2016 were basically the one child, were even a bit younger even. So these would be people, you know, born in the 1990s, maybe the late 80s. So these are really children of, there's a lot of poor people in China, but at least on average, people who are much more prosperous than a generation ago. And also there's many fewer of them than a generation ago also. So if you combine the fact that there's much higher income per capita for that generation, much higher education, and many, many fewer of them, if you're worried about the development process and you're worried about food supply, the behavioral choices of that generation are not likely to lead to some, you know, four children per household all over again. Like, basically, I think they ended the one-child policy right about when the choices of the population share that would be having children, you know, the family, what is it called? I can't remember the phrase. Anyway, the age of the population share that is likely to start a family was very small already. And they had preferences that would probably not produce big families. So basically, there was no fear of return to big China by the time that they took away that policy, in my view. That's it. Like they knew that not many families would have more than two children, if two at all.
I think you're absolutely right, because when I've asked my friends and colleagues, you know, whether they would like to have a second child, they would say yes, but it is extremely expensive to raise this one child that I have.
Yes.
And, you know, schools cost a lot of money and, you know, we want to send them abroad. And so there was this kind of feeling that even though they could, they wouldn't want to because of financial pressures.
Yeah. So like, I think it was ended or turned to a two-child policy and perhaps soon and any number of children you want policy, really when that shift happened, that the behavioral choices of young people in China, young adults in China, really reflected the behavioral choices of people in wealthy countries. Maybe, I'm not saying that is necessarily the case for the rural poor, but on average, at least you have the preference is not to have large families anymore. And that so that their behavior would almost reflect a one-child policy, even if it wasn't an imposed decision.
Let's move on to Africa, or actually return to Africa, since we discussed this earlier. Lauren, there's been a lot of talk about how youthful Africa's population is, and the continent is drawing all kinds of attention in terms of all the opportunities and that this young population represents. But there are also risks, apparently, in terms of, some people would say, even though there's a lot of space, because of poverty, inequality, because of lack of development, that one can't just not prioritize family planning. And you've argued, I think, if I'm not mistaken, that China's economic demography transition strategy could have some illustrative lessons for other countries. So given that Africa is, and by the way, the African continent is a very heterogeneous kind of continent, as you were saying earlier, that there are some countries, I think you've written in one of your articles that it is Middle Africa that is usually the youngest, and countries like Angola, Cameroon, Democratic Republic of Congo, etc., whereas Northern Africa is the oldest. So it's not like all countries are young. But what are your thoughts on this matter, Lauren, of what could African countries learn from the Chinese experience?
Yeah, I just to say from the outset, my comparison of the two is nothing to do with family planning. Like I have no position on any country's family planning policies and which is, you know, optimal and which isn't. I think the crux of what can be learned from China is a conscious co-integration of demographics and economics. You know, so in China's case, they've constantly planned out national development, understanding how their population was changing. So, you know, they started implementing policies to cater for aging from the early 1980s, even though their population was super young. And even though at the time the culture was that families take care of the old, I think they understood that that propensity might diminish as the country got rich. So they would need more formal institutions for aging care and so on. So they've been planning and understanding that as life, as per capita income increases, life expectancy increases. So you need to also be ready to cater to the old, whether formally or informally. And then on the sense of this, you know, demographic dividend, there are, I mean, I don't think many countries, only Mauritius and maybe Morocco, I can't remember, have total fertility rates that are below replacement. And just a handful of countries are kind of in demographic prime. But the bulk of countries in Africa using those World Development Indicator statistics do have a falling TFR. And, you know, depending what happens to the falling TFR and the working age population share, they will enter a period of demographic dividend or so on. And so I guess the lesson from China is just to, where even if your country stays demographically young, work out a development strategy that caters to that population structure, you know, and, you know, kind of defy Malthus or defy what it, like work out a population structure, what is it, complementary strategy. And China has done that through its youthful period, through its working age, rich period. And it's trying now with a high and increasing population share of old. So, for example, China's gaining kind of industrial strengths and encouraging investing in all sorts of things from like walking frames to wheelchairs to technology that can support and help old people, to even the fact that there's a village in China that now provides Japan with most of its coffins. So they've really entered into the comparative advantages of having a high population age working share, a high retired population share. So how do you capture that value? How do you make the most? How do you turn a large elderly population share to your long run advantage? And conversely, in Africa's case, how would you turn a large youthful population share to your advantage? And different in a kind of a bigger sense, you know, when China was in its demographic prime in the 1990s and 2000s, the West was also in its demographic prime, but it was a rich, high-income demographic bubble. So you had this low-income bubble met, or middle-income bubble met, a high-income bubble. And now both of those have kind of popped, so to speak, and they're both in demographic working-age prime decline. And that creates a very different global economy for young countries in Africa. you know, interest rates are low compared to before. And part of that is population aging. And, you know, labor force shares are shrinking and services. So there's all sorts of, it's a whole new world in which Africa will be in its demographic prime. You know, it's not meeting a demographic rich West. It's not meeting a demographic rich China. It will be the kind of youngest prime. And I just think there needs to be strategies that capitalize on that. And whether that means the population structure changes or whether a country stays young, I'm not judging that. I just think you need a strategy that really domestic and international that caters to your population structure and your economy and how it changes over time. And that to me is the lesson from China. China's really been active in trying to manage the parallel worlds of population and development.
A final set of issues, and this is related to the previous question, Lauren. As we all live longer, and you know, not just in Europe or in the United States and Asia, but also in Latin America, in Africa, you have a population that maybe is still below the poverty line, but is living longer. And I've seen some interest among Western aid agencies in terms of providing pensions or thinking about how to actually support the elderly poor in many of these low-income countries. Don't you think the kind of experience, the more recent experience that China has had in terms of pensions and pension reforms, all of those experiences could perhaps be applied elsewhere? I don't know the extent to which that has worked, pension reforms, et cetera, in India, but I know that in China, there's considerable focus on that. Is that an area that you think others could learn from too?
Yeah, I think population aging and pensions appear to be a difficult topic everywhere and difficult to get right. So even Mauritius, I think, was the first country to implement kind of countrywide old age pension support. And they have to kind of tinker with it every year, every few years to try and help it be sustainable. In China's case, it certainly hasn't got a perfect system, but it's been trying to implement some sort of very basic old age support for the poorest of the old, which, you know, I guess doesn't exist in poor countries. So I remember even back from my master's degree at SOAS in the early 2000s, the African economies lecturer talking about old age poverty in South Africa and how terrible it was, and particularly women, because women live longer, but they have lower savings from their lifetime and so on. And if one of their children has died or so on, then it's like a terrible state of poverty in old age. And I guess, you know, the dimensions of when you have a traditional population structure, you typically have child poverty. But as populations live longer and so on, then poverty shifts to the older cohort on average. But this varies. In the West, pensioners are quite rich, relatively. That's because they're old after rich. So I guess that the point is that, you know, maybe don't underestimate how quickly life expectancy might increase. And if and as life expectancy increases, don't just celebrate that as an achievement, but at every step, continually adjust the system so that you can cater to that longer lifespan. Because if you take it for granted, and as the population shifts, there'll probably be all these constraints that open up over time. So African countries, for example, might be best positioned to somehow, if they can already, it might be tricky even there, but to start like an annual reevaluation of the retirement age. And so that every year you reconsider, does it make sense that the retirement age is 60, given all these trends? No, it doesn't. And so China just very recently has done something interesting where, you know, like it hasn't been able to increase the retirement age. There's been protests and so on. And part of that is this generation from the 50s and 60s, you know, had a very difficult lifespan in China. They weren't the kind of richer, more privileged urban, at least, cohort born in the 1990s and 2000s. And they feel entitled to retire. They don't, they're mostly working like, you know, labor. They're not office workers. They don't have university degrees and they want to retire and they think they should be able to. So now China has, it's almost going through like a retirement age transition period where for people born in whenever, let's say 1960 or 1965, they might have to work an extra 3 months longer. And then the ones born in 1996 will have to work an extra 6 months longer. And the ones born in 1967, an extra 9 months longer. And this will go on until somehow they find a point where everybody will kind of, or maybe even it will be continuously adjusted based on the lifespan of a person born in any year. And then there's all sorts of other complexities. And I mean, in terms of the lifespan of people who've done manual labor is lower than people who've done office labor and so on. So I guess the point for a young country today is to look at the hurdles being faced by old countries today. And if it's possible, to try to implement policies that avoid those hurdles, because you might be surprised how quickly your country gets old as well. And if it does, that's a great thing because people are living longer and they're healthier. But don't waste the chance to create more flexible systems that can help you cope with that aging from much earlier on. Like, really learn from the problems of aging in richer countries and even in China, which is old before rich.
It was great chatting with you today, Lauren. Thank you so much for coming on my show.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please spread the news among your friends and share it on social media. The Twitter handle for this podcast is GlobalDevPod.
Thank you for listening to In Pursuit of Development with Professor Dan Banik from the University of Oslo's Center for Development and the Environment. Please email your questions, comments, and suggestions to inpursuitofdevelopment@gmail.com.